Yeah, I'm fine. Okay, Boker Tov, good morning. My name is Rabbi Alan Haber, and I was asked to give a series of shiurim on Mishnayot. I understand that the theme this summer is to devote 1 week to each of the first three sedarim, the first three orders of Mishnayot, and that would mean that this week is Seder Zraim. I'll be teaching, God willing, today, tomorrow, and Tuesday. Wednesday, I can't make it, someone else is going to teach. But, you know, when asked to teach Mishnayot and Seder Zraim, the first instinct is to turn to Masechet Brachot, which, among all the tractates in the Seder of Zraim, is the one that's certainly most familiar to people, most commonly studied. That was the first instinct, and then after talking about it for a few moments, we realized that that would probably be a missed opportunity. Because if we're already going to be looking at Mishnayot in a fairly limited forum, which doesn't give us the opportunity to go into too much depth, in any case, then it seems that it's a very good opportunity to examine some of the other Masechtot, some of the other tractates in Seder Zraim, which are less familiar, less commonly studied, and perhaps to many, if not to all of you, much less familiar, perhaps not familiar at all. So what we're going to do, God, and therefore for that same reason also, instead of picking one subject to go into in a little bit more depth, what I elected to do is to do a little bit each of the few days of different tractates in this Masechet in order to sort of give us an exposure to a whole area of Torah law that to many of us is just a closed book. So Bezrat Hashem, today we're going to discuss Masechet Pe'ah, and we'll look at a few of the Mishnayot in there. And tomorrow, God willing, Masechet Trumot, Ma'asrot, and Ma'asir Sheni. Again, obviously just some small selections. And on Tuesday, God willing, Masechet Shvi'it. And I'm not sure what you'll be doing on Wednesday. When I spoke with her, she wasn't sure yet what she wanted to do. But Seder Zraim, of course, the word Zraim means seeds, right? I saw the advertisement, wine, women, and seeds. So today is seeds. And this is the area of the Talmud that discusses agricultural laws. And I think there are two main reasons why these Masechtot are far less commonly studied than other areas of the Talmud. One of the reasons why there's just less attention that's been paid to them over the centuries is because many of the laws that are covered in these Masechtot only apply in the land of Israel and not in exile. And therefore, for much of our history, these laws were not of practical significance. In fact, fascinatingly, in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, there is no Gemara on any of these tractates in this entire Seder, with the exception of Brachot. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, which was formulated here in Eretz Israel, there is. So you see that already in the time of the Talmud, it clearly, in Chutz La'aretz, where these laws did not have practical application, or many of them didn't, there were some discussions of these laws scattered through other Masechta, but there's no systematic discussion of most of these Mishnayot in the Babylonian Talmud, and there is in the Talmud Yerushalmi, because the Jews who were here in Israel studied these laws more in depth because they kept these laws, whereas in Babylonia they were theoretical, and unfortunately for most of our history they remain theoretical. That's one reason. And some of these laws are attracting attention of poskei halakha who need to make practical decisions. In our generation, for the first time in a few thousand years, there's serious halachic work, or maybe I should say in our generation and one or two before that, beginning, let's say, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Chazon Ish and Rav Kook and others, in many cases, for the first time in several thousand years, had to deal with very practical questions. For the first time, we had Jewish farmers again in the land of Israel. So that was certainly one of the reasons. You know, maybe I should leave these over here. Maybe
yeah, that would be better.
Wait, I need to work myself. So that's one reason. The second thing, though, also is that when the Torah gave these laws and when they were formulated by the rabbis, society was very different than it is today. You're talking about a pre-industrial agricultural society. Our ancestors, like most of the world, but particularly here in the land of Israel, our ancestors were almost all of them were farmers. who had little small family plots, and agriculture and farming was their way of life. Today, of course, it's very, very different. We still have agriculture today, of course. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to eat. But it's all been industrialized. So today, I think in the state of Israel, I think 2% of the population grows all the food that we all eat, and they also export. And therefore, I imagine in other parts of the world, it's probably, this is a country that puts an emphasis on agriculture. So the amount of people that are actually involved in this today are very, very small percentage of the population. And it's done, although all the same agricultural activities need to be done, but they're done on a huge industrial scale and with modern equipment, which just changes everything. And therefore, what we're going to see is that although these laws in many cases still apply, some of them do apply, most of them apply on some level nowadays, we're not always able to keep them properly. In some cases, like the laws we're going to study today, for reasons that will become clear in a few minutes, in theory the law applies, in practice it's impossible to observe these laws the way the Torah intended them, and it's still worth studying them, first of all, because it's Torah, and it's Dvar Hashem, it's the Word of God, and therefore by definition, I believe at least that studying Torah is of extreme relevance, even if I'm studying laws that I can't actually keep in a practical sense. There's still much to be learned from it. In this case, we have laws which, in theory, do apply. In practice, we can try to keep the spirit of the law, even though the actual letter of the law, for reasons that we'll see, doesn't really have practical ramifications nowadays. The laws we're going to look at tomorrow, it's actually the reverse. We have to keep a lot of the letter of the law, even though, unfortunately, in our current circumstances, I'm talking tomorrow about Trumot and Masrot, most of the spirit of the law is something we cannot do, and yet we're obligated to follow the letter of the law and to find various technical ways to fulfill the letter of the law, even though the spirit of the law remains something that perhaps we can dream of one day once again fulfilling. And on Tuesday, when we'll look at the laws of Shemitah, we'll see a situation where on some level, both the letter and the spirit is able to be observed, although we're still far from the total vision of what the Torah had in mind. So that's what I hope to accomplish in just the few hours we have to study these Mishnayot. So today we're looking at Masechet Pe'ah. On the sheet I gave you, and I have to apologize, I gave English translations for those who it will be helpful for the biblical passages. Unfortunately, I was not able to find any sort of English translation of the Mishnayot that I could easily cut and paste into the document, so I apologize to the Mishnayot. I'll have to translate myself. But if you could just look for a moment at the two short biblical passages that we put there on the page. There are two psukim in Vayikra and three psukim in Dvarim. These discuss the laws, these list out the Torah laws that are discussed in Masechet Pe'ah. If I could ask everyone to just take a moment, there's sheets over there on the, right over there. If I could ask everyone to just read them to yourself quietly and try to see if you can make a list in your head or on paper if you'd like, how many different laws we have here and what they are. So what's the headline? What's the kotera? What's the common denominator behind all these laws before we get into details?
Thou shalt
not. Okay.
Yes, thou shalt.
Correct. There are many things in the Torah that thou shalt not do. Half of them, actually less than half of the laws in the Torah are thou shalt, and the other are thou shalt not. What specifically unifies all these laws? Yes?
Loving kindness.
Okay.
Stop loving kindness.
Meaning?
Don't expect anything back.
Okay, so actually, there's a thou shalt not that's followed by a thou shalt.
Yes.
Right? Thou shalt not
that
take these things for thyself.
But thou shalt leave it there.
Shall leave it there for?
Whoever. You know, those people.
For which people?
They're
poor, right? Mm-hmm. These are what we call matnot aniyim. Gifts to the poor. And the Torah commands us to provide what we call tzedakah, charity, but this is a particular form of tzedakah, right? There are general laws that require us to help a person in need. Somebody needs a monetary gift or a loan. We're obligated, if we're able to provide that. That's dealt with elsewhere in the Torah. These are specific matnot aniyim, specific gifts for the poor that are legislated on a farmer. If you will, it's almost a form of a tax, a welfare tax, if you will, right? That the farmer is obligated to give certain, well, we'll see that's not actually a certain percentage, but certain aspects from his crop. As the farmer is harvesting his crops, again, we have to put ourselves in, at the end, we'll try to talk about how we can observe these laws nowadays, why we can't observe them this way, and what we should do instead. But let's put ourselves in the mindset of the pre-modern, pre-industrial agricultural society, right, where you have people who aren't poor have small plots of land, or maybe somebody has larger plots of land, where everyone is growing their own produce. By the way, one of the advantages of being here in Eretz Yisrael, when you do learn these laws, if you want to learn them in depth, is that we're able to see with our own eyes. If we would leave this classroom, and I know there's a tool, I'm not sure if you're going to be doing any of that, but you can go to places in this country where you can see agriculture still being done very much in similar methods to the way it was done in the Mishnah. There are certain sites where ancient agricultural methods have been reconstructed for the purpose of education. But you can also go, particularly among the Arabs, the local Arabs around here, many of them are still farming the land more or less in the same way it used to be done. And you know, you can get a sense of how some, you know, you can just see with your own eyes a lot better some of these things than you can do if you study these laws elsewhere. But without getting into those details, just put ourselves in the mindset of the small agricultural society and recognize that you have plots of land that are being farmed. And the poor people are those who probably don't have land, either because they never had land. They may be a ger, a stranger, an immigrant who came into the country and didn't have land. They might be the Levi, who the Torah mentions here, actually not in these psukim, but in other psukim, the Levi is mentioned, who also doesn't have land and therefore at times is going to be poor. It might be a widow who maybe had land, but certainly in those days a woman wasn't capable, generally speaking, of working the land herself, and therefore she might have had to sell her land off and now may have nothing, or an orphan or something, somebody like that. So how are we going to provide for those people through the agricultural process? So what do we have here? How many different laws do we have here?
Came up with seven.
Seven? Okay, so what are they? Well, let's read it through together.
Yeah.
Okay, uvekutzrichem et kitzir artzichem. We're talking about a harvest. A harvest here we're talking about in a field, as opposed to an orchard or a vineyard. We'll get to those in a minute. Okay, so we're talking about a grain field. The main crops in Eretz Yisrael were always dagan, tirosh, v'yitzhar. Dagan are grains, chiefly wheat and barley and various subspecies of those. That's grains. Those are grown in large open fields. And wine, which is grown obviously in vineyards. And olives, which are grown in olive groves. There are also other fruits, as we know. We know the seven species, rimonim, te'enim, etc. And they also grew vegetables and kidneyot, various types of beans. So we're talking first about a field, chiefly a grain field of wheat or barley. Uvekutzrichem et kitzir artzichem. Lo tichale pe'at sadcha liktzor. So that's called pe'at. What does that mean? A corner or the edge, actually. The word pe'at in biblical Hebrew doesn't have to mean a corner, but the edge, right? So the edge of your field, they actually translate it as corner. That's interesting. This is the 1929 JPS translation of the Bible. That's what I found online. Because the newer edition is copyrighted, so you can't get it online. So that's why they give you the old one with the when ye reap and thy and all, you know, the archaic English. So you have to leave the edge of the field unharvested. Let's say this desk is my field, and I'm going through the field and harvesting. I have to stop before I reach the edge. the edge or a corner, some place at the edge of the field I have to leave unharvested. That's one thing. So we'll call that here the edge of the field. Okay. Vileket kitzircha lo tilaket. How do they translate that? Neither shalt thou gather the gleaning of thy harvest. So that's leket. Anyone know what gleaning means?
Yes.
Right. What happens is, and we'll see this in a Mishnah, when you harvest wheat, right, wheat grows in tall stalks that are roughly the height of a person, and when it's harvested by hand, it's a kli called a magal, a sickle, right? That's, remember from the old Russian flag, right? That curved knife. The reason it's shaped that way is what you do is you actually grab it with your arm like this, like sort of, and then you harvest it like that. And then you have a bundle of wheat that you can then, you generally put down on the ground, tie it up, and move on to the next one, and then you're going to go back afterwards and gather those bundles to be taken to the threshing floor, etc. Along the way, when you do that, you're going to have individual stalks that fall down. Right? You grab, I don't know how many stalks of wheat, and you sweep it away. So here and there, some are going to fall out of your hands. Little individual stalks of wheat are going to land on the ground, and you're obligated to leave them there. Don't go back and pick them up. Leave them on the ground there. That's the next one. Okay, we'll get to the kerem in a minute. Okay, so that's the... Okay, let's deal with that. That's in the field. We'll see there's a third one here in a minute, but let's move to a kerem, which is a vineyard. In the vineyard, it tells us, v'charmecha lo te'olel u'peret karmecha lo te'lakit. So where is the field? It spoke about peah and leke. In the vineyard, we have what's called olelot and peret. Olelot, I don't know how well they translated that here.
Small grapes.
Correct. Small. Well, it's not necessarily small grapes, it's individual grapes. You know, as grapes normally grow in large clusters, but you'll have here and there a branch of the grapevine that didn't fully develop and only has a few grapes on it. So those you have to leave. Those are called olelot. Let's call them small individual grapes. To leave those on the vine. You're going to go through and do your industrial harvest. You're going to take your pruning shears and you're going to cut off the large clusters of grapes that you're going to take, generally speaking, be pressed into wine. And here and there, you're going to find these small clusters of individual grapes. You're going to leave them there. And peret karmecha lo tilaket. Peret is similar to leket. It's individual grapes that fall down. Okay? So, I guess I'll call that gleaning also. Same kind of thing. Okay, and then what are you supposed to do with them? Right? I have to leave the edge of my field. I have to leave small grapes on the vine. I have to leave things that fall on the ground. Why? What do I do with them? Le'ani v'lager ta'azavotam. I have to leave them there. When I finish my harvest, and I've taken everything away from the field, there are going to be some things left behind. And then the poor people are allowed to come in and take them. We're familiar with this, of course. I think I saw that there's a class on Megillat Rut. Right? Right? This is exactly what was doing. Naomi sent her out. It was the time of the harvest, around Shavuot time, and Naomi said they had no food. Right? You had an elderly widow, whose family had already sold off her field. Eventually, the field was redeemed. That's the end of the story by Boaz. When she came back from Moab, right? Her husband died. Her children died. It's a tragic story. She was a wealthy woman at one point. They moved to Moab, and everybody died. She came back with her young daughter-in-law, and she had nothing. They were living in poverty. She sent her daughter-in-law out to go and benefit from the mitzvah of leket. And if you read Megillat Rut, it talks about how she went acharei ha-kotrim, after the harvesters. They had the teams of workers that were harvesting the field. And the poor people were allowed to come after them. The harvesters go through the field. And when they're finished, there's leket. There are things on the ground that are, and the poor people go and pick up these small little pieces of grains. And they can come home at the end of the day with perhaps enough to bake a loaf of bread out of, or maybe a little bit more than that. Okay, so that's peyah and leket. Ki tiktzor, now the psukim in Dvarim, ki tiktzor kitzircha basadecha v'shachachta omer basadeh. Omer is already a whole bundle, right? You made those bundles, and you put them down, and then you go through the field a second time. After you've harvested, you have to now go back and pick up all those bundles and put them into a whole, like a stack, which you're then going to take to be threshed into the threshing is the process of removing the inedible parts and getting just the seeds, and then you take those seeds to the mill to grind it into flour, and eventually it becomes bread. Right? So during the first step of the process is the actual harvesting. There's peret, there's individual stalks that fall down. But most of the stalks you put together in bundles, and the poor people are not allowed to take those bundles. They're only allowed to take the individual stalks. Then when you go through the field a second time to collect those bundles, you may forget one, you may miss one. And once you realize that you missed it, you're not allowed to go back. That's called shichicha. Shichicha, the forgotten bundle. Wrong. Okay, so this also has to be left for the poor people. Lo tashuv lekachto, don't go back and take it. Lager le'atom b'la'al mana yeh, leave it for the stranger, the widow, the orphan, the poor people. L'man yivarechecha Hashem alakecha. Ooh, I meant to take the Shem Hashem off. Please be careful with this paper. I missed one. Okay, so it's got the full pasuk there. It should be treated properly. L'man yivarechecha Hashem alakecha b'chol ma'asei adecha. So that God will bless you, and then it also mentions ki tachbod zeitecha when you're harvesting the olives off your olive groves, lo tifayer acharecha, which the rabbis understand to mean also the mitzvah of leket. Okay, so of peah. Lager v'lamana la'atom l'amana yeah, and mentions also here the olulot, etc. Okay, so it turns out that in a field we have three laws that apply: leket, shikcha, and peah. In a vineyard we actually have four. The Torah mentions peret and olulot, peret being similar to leket, and olulot being a special law that applies only to the vineyard. But the rabbis tell us that leket and peah apply to a vineyard as well. Not leket, I'm sorry. Shechecha. Peah and shechecha apply to a vineyard as well. And the when we deal with an orchard, so we have only two of the laws. We have the law of Pe'ah and the law of Leket. Because Shechecha doesn't really apply to fruit trees so easily. And therefore, we only have two of the four laws. Okay, but that means that, and this is before, by the way, this is before the farmer goes to what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow he pays his taxes. Okay, just like today, you earn 100 shekels, you take home, if you're lucky, 65 or 70 shekels, right? Because they take off all the taxes. Same thing is being done in the Torah, but in a different way. We're going to see tomorrow that after you harvest your crops, you have to take off truma and ma'aser rishon, and either ma'aser sheni or ma'aser ani, which are various forms of taxes. And you're only going to take home about 81% of your crops. That's going to be your, what we call in Israel today, your netto, right? Your net income. The bruto is the 100%, and then you got to pay the taxes. That's tomorrow. This is before that. This doesn't count into that calculation. These are just things that perhaps the Torah commanded you, either because I'm speculating. This is divine law. I can't tell you exactly what the reason is, but the concept seems to be: look, you're going to harvest your field, but you don't need to take every last little thing. The things that, for your purposes as a farmer who's working on, even if you're providing only for your own family, and even if you're not planning to take your produce to market, but you're still working on some sort of an industrial scale. And if you're providing for your own family, you're still harvesting a year's worth of food here, right? And in many cases, you may be planning to take it to market. Okay, you're not going to miss a few little grapes. It's not necessarily significant to you, those little pieces that fall down. You forgot something in the field. You forgot it anyway. It must not have been that important to you. Leave that for someone else. And this is before we deal with the taxation of the trumot and maaserot. Okay, so this is the concept here. And you have to let, and then the poor people become part of the harvest. They come and part, and they don't own the land. They didn't work the land. Okay, but they benefit from the harvest as well. They're not left out in the cold. Okay, so this is the concept. Now, what the rabbis need to do, I could sit here if I wanted to, and we could go through an in-depth discussion of, as you mentioned earlier, there's a commandment here of loving kindness. There's a commandment here of a certain amount of compassion, of understanding. And again, when we read Gilat Rut, it helps us to, you know, sort of personalize it by showing us a spotlight on an individual situation of an actual person or a family even that had gone through a terrible tragedy. And the wealthy landowner Boaz, who wealthy
Sorry. I was trying to be discreet.
The wealthy landowner, owner Boaz, who shows great magnificence and goes beyond even what the law requires and makes sure to give Ruth extra gifts, and he's sort of impressed with her dignity and with her willingness to sacrifice. Perhaps he found out who she was, and after all, she was a young person from a wealthy family, even from royalty, who didn't need to do this, and she came out of dedication to her mother-in-law, and perhaps out of dedication to an identification with Am Yisrael, with Am Yisrael's values, and chose a life of poverty. And from that, of course, comes David HaMelech. That's the whole story of Megillat Ruth. We can have a very beautiful, and I assume you will, if this is going to be a class in Megillat Ruth, and analysis of what that all means in terms of the message here of what the Torah is teaching us by these laws. But these are laws. And that means what the rabbis need to do is they need to translate this into practical terms. If I'm a farmer, okay, and this is not, I didn't just go to shul on Shabbat and the rabbi get up and give a drasha about, you know, remembering the poor people and just sort of leave it up to me to feel a certain amount of compassion and do whatever I feel is right. The Torah gave me very specific commands. It's prohibited, right? Like you said, thou shalt not harvest the end of your field. Thou shalt not pick up the pieces that fall down or the bundles that you forgot, etc. If we're going to look at this as law, then we're going to have to deal with all sorts of details. So before we look at the Mishnah, let's ask ourselves questions. Imagine you had a field and you want to fulfill these laws. What sort of questions would you need to ask? Practically speaking. Yes. Exactly. How much? Right? The edge of the field. How far? How big? In the corner? At the edge? How much? Excellent question. What else? Yes. What exactly is olam? We define them as small individual grapes, but what does that mean? How big? Or how many at a time? Right? If there's three grapes, can I take them? What if there's five? What if there's seven? Right? Okay, excellent. What else? Right, how much? Okay, so even if we figure, right, even if we figure it out for a field, when we apply it to a vineyard or to an orchard, it's different, right? Does it go by the trees or just by the fruits, right? Yes?
If you have a basket full of something and you drop it, can you pick all that stuff up again?
Okay, right. What's called blechet, right? If I understand if I drop an individual, what if I'm harvesting, it's not in a basket, right? What if I just drop the whole thing? Or a basket of grapes. What if it falls over? Correct. Okay, good. Yes.
The same thing with Shabbat. How far do you go? Let's say you put it down and I walk 2 feet.
Right.
Does that mean it's gone?
Is that called forgetting? My phone rang or someone called me and I looked away for a second and I forgot. Excellent. What?
Sneeze,
right? For sure. Okay, ladies, every single one of those questions that you asked is addressed by the Mishnah. And the rabbis have to answer them, and others as well. I don't know how many of them we'll get to, but let's take a look, okay? I'll have to read through these Mishnayot, and I'll try to explain them. I don't know if we'll get through everything I put on these two pages, but let's see what we get through. I want to make sure to leave a little bit of time at the end also to talk about the practical ramifications. So let's take a look at the first one, the very it's the second Mishnah in Masechet Peah. Ein pochatin lepeah mishishim, af al pi she'amru ein lepeah shi'ur. Okay, so this addresses the first question that was asked here, which is, how much? How much do you have to leave? And the Mishnah gives a very enigmatic response. First of all, it tells me how much. Or at least it tells me a minimum. You're welcome to give more. But you can't give less than shishim. Less than 60, meaning what? 1/60th, okay? So I don't know what that would come out. That's probably like 1.15% or something like that. No? More? I don't know, you calculate it. 1/60th of the field is the minimum that you have to leave as peah. But then it says, af al pi she'amru ein lepeah shiur. Even though the rabbis taught us that there is no measurement for peah. So that's a contradiction. You tell me there's no measurement, but you just gave me a measurement. Anyone want to try to figure out what that means? If not, I'll just tell you. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, the Mishnah says that there is a limit, there's a minimum amount, what's called a shi'ur, there's a minimum amount that you have to leave at least one ein pochatin. You're not allowed to do less, you're not allowed to leave less than 1/60th of a field, even though they said that there is no measurement. So what that means is that min ha-Torah. The Torah's commandment, the way the Torah gave it, could be fulfilled with the smallest amount possible. As long as you leave something, the Torah didn't say how much. Not in the actual written Torah, nor in the oral interpretation of the biblical law. If you leave, you have to leave something. But if you leave even one stalk of wheat or a few stalks of wheat, min ha-Torah, you have fulfilled the requirement. Of course, that doesn't seem to be what the Torah intended. And therefore, the rabbis came along and midrabanan legislated. So, although the Torah gave no limit, and this is far from the only example like this, the rabbis decided to give it a formalized amount, and they said it cannot be less than 1/60. But then they go on and they say, don't think that that is the end of the story either. Hakol lefi godel hasadeh ulefi rov ha'aniim ulefi ha'anava. However, in practical terms, what you're supposed to do, the minimum is 1/60. That doesn't mean that you should only give 1/60. It could be that you could and should give more. It depends how big your field is. Somebody who has a very large field and has such an abundance, perhaps you'd be giving a little bit more than that. Lefi rov ha'aniim, it also depends how great the need is. Are there a lot of poor people, or are there only a few poor people? If the minimum amount will suffice the needs of the poor people, then there's even someone with a very large field isn't required to leave over extra if it's not necessary. On the other hand, if there is, unfortunately, it's a very bad economic time and there are a lot of people in need, then the landowner needs for himself and his own family too, but he's expected to push himself a little further and realize that there's very great need here. And also the firov ha'anava, which means how much rain fell that year and how abundant the crop was. The same field one year might provide much, much more abundant crop than it did a different year, and obviously that's going to be part of the calculation as well. Okay, so that's the first point. We have to give minimum of 1/60, midrabanan, but if possible, if necessary and possible, more than that. Second Mishnah, where are you supposed to leave? Yes?
Are they going to ever define what is a poor person?
Yes. I don't know if I put it on the sheet here.
It's probably very easily defined.
Excellent. That's an excellent question. The last few Mishnayot here, which I'll try to get to, addresses exactly that question also. Who's entitled to take this payout? Right? One person, I'll try to do it, yeah. Okay, I'll keep my eye on the clock, yes. And by the way, I'll just mention that saying that you can't give less than 1/60, but you can give more, is actually a significant statement. You might think, well, obviously I can give more. No one's going to tell me I can't give more. But it's significant to say that you can give more for the following reason. I can always give charity. That's fine. But that doesn't mean that my charity is defined as payah. And it is significant. When I fulfill the mitzvah of payah, it's one thing. If I decide out of the goodness of my heart, to leave something else for the poor people besides the payah, that's very nice, but it's not payah. What difference does it make? We're going to see that when the poor people collect the payah, they are exempt. That produce that was in the payah is exempt from the laws we're going to look at tomorrow, the laws of Trumot and Ma'asrot. The poor person takes the payah home, and he can eat 100% of it. Okay. If I choose to leave other things available for them that aren't in the framework of payah, that's very nice of me, but that doesn't exempt whoever takes this, including the poor people, from removing the Trumot and Ma'asrot from it. So by the Mishnah telling me that I'm not limited to 1/60, if I choose to give 1/40, it's all considered, if I do it in this way, it's all considered payah. That's a significant statement, because that means that it's all within that exemption from the other laws that would otherwise apply. Okay, so that's when it comes, you want to ask that?
Just a quick question. The concept of buffalo shishin, 1/60 also, in contrast, does that come from this?
I don't think it comes from that, but I do think that the rabbis had this concept of 1/60 as being the smallest significant percentage. I once saw a very fascinating insight. There are a number of places in the Talmud where the term, in a not legal sense, where the term 1/60, for example, the Talmud makes a statement that sleep is considered 1/60 of death. Right? There's a certain concept when we wake up in the morning, we say, Modeh lefanecha, shechazarta binishmati. There's a certain sense that the person's asleep is not fully alive, and that waking up in the morning is a certain form of almost resurrection, and they use the term 1/60th. And the term applies in other places also. So it's like a funny, right? So someone, I once saw, I don't remember where I saw this, someone suggested that the term 1/60th means the smallest amount that's still significant. Right? In kashrus, we know that, right? If a drop of milk falls into your meat, if there's 1/60th, it's still, well, it has to be less than 1/60th, right? It has to be at least, or it has to be exact, right. If you're 60 times as much, which means the milk is 1/61, right? And there's 1/60th is the smallest amount that's not considered meaningless. So it could be that they're applying a similar, it's not the same law, but there could be they're applying a similar concept here. You know, the minimum you have to give is 1/60th. If you leave less than that, that's minat Torah, perhaps you're fulfilled the mitzvah, but come on, that's not noticeable even. 1/60th is small but significant. Yes.
Would the person collecting be responsible to know if it's more than who's gonna be responsible for that?
How does he know it's the payah? Even. Right?
How would he know the
okay, excellent. So that brings us right to the next mishnah. Let's take a look at the next mishnah now. Nonin pe'a mitchilat hasadeh u'me'emtza'a. I won't go into the rest of that Mishnah because I see that the time is ticking away, so but let's just focus on the concept. The Torah spoke about the edge of the field. What if I choose to leave the middle of the field? So what difference does it make? I have to leave something for the poor people. What if I choose to leave the middle of the field? I'm gonna leave this section of the field unharvested and tell the poor people they can go there. So the Mishnah says that counts. It counts as peah. There's a discussion later on what that means. Some say that it counts as peah in the sense that the poor people can take it and are exempt from Trumot U'Masrot, but I still have to go and do it again at the edge. And others say, no, I've fulfilled it. But it's clear that that's what we call bidyeved. L'chatchila, ideally, the Torah wants it at the edge of the field. And the question is, why? Why do we care where it is? Yes? Okay, that's interesting.
Yes.
The Gemara, that's interesting, although I'm not sure it's any less embarrassing to take from the edge than from...
You're less noticeable.
Oh, could be.
You know, you come together, you go to the edge of your eye.
Could be.
Go through the middle.
It could be. I'm not sure, though, that the... again, this is the type of thing where if we would go and stand in a field, we might understand it a little bit better. I'm not sure to what extent that's true. It might be true. Okay, the Gemara actually gives a number of other rationales, though, which are a little bit more practical, and they have to do with avoiding both misunderstanding and abuse. First of all, the Gemara says, we want to make sure that the poor people get a fair shot, right? If I can leave peah anywhere, the edge of the field, the way you harvest the field, you start at one end and you go to the other end. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end. And if I could leave peah in the middle of my field, so first of all, what I might do is, I got a cousin who's poor, right? I'll tell him, listen, come on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And all of a sudden I'll say, this is peah! And he'll get it, and it's not fair to the other poor people. If it has to be at the edge of the field, the poor people walk around, they say, okay, that guy, he's not going to get to the edge for another 3 days, I'm going to go here, and they know where to go, and it sort of makes it fair to everybody. It also, the Gemara also talks about, if we let you leave peah anywhere in the field, the poor people are going to have to stand around waiting. They don't know when the peah is coming. It's not a good use of their time. Right? They should be going to other people's fields, or maybe they should be trying to get a job. If we can make them stand around all day waiting for their welfare payments, right? So that's not good. Also, the Gemara talks about, we also don't want to cast aspersions on the landowner. Right? Somebody comes along and sees me harvesting the very last grains of my field. They say, that guy, he didn't leave peah. Meanwhile, they don't know that last week I left a whole chunk for the poor people, but it cast aspersions on me. If it's always at the edge, then it'll be very clear who fulfilled the mitzvah and who didn't. So that seems to be the rationale. But what this Mishnah tells us is that if you did declare peah in a different part of the field, at least for the Evet, it's valid anyway, but it's supposed to be at the edge. The next Mishnah discusses, and again, I'll just touch on this very briefly, discusses something that wasn't asked here. What sort of crops does this apply to? Does this apply to anything you grow? Or maybe not. Klal amru b'peah, kol shu ochel. First of all, this only applies to food. Someone grows cotton. Someone grows various types of plants that are used for making dyes or other things. Right? There are crops that are not for consumption, that are grown for other purposes that have economic value. They're not obligated. A person has a cotton field, he doesn't have to observe the mitzvah of Peah. He has other mitzvot he has to observe, perhaps, but not this. Vinishmar, it only applies to a land that was owned by a person and cultivated by a person who guarded that land, and as opposed to hefker. Okay, if I go out into the, if I find some wild berries growing, and I decide to go and I find in the woods, you know, a whole patch of berries, and I'm going to go and harvest those berries for myself, that's completely legitimate. It's hefker, nobody owns it. That's fine. And then I'm not obligated to leave pay. It's not my field, I can take it. The poor person can take it too, anyone can take it. It only applies to things that grew from the ground as opposed to other types of crops, mushrooms and certain other types of things which are not considered to have grown from the ground, they're exempt from this law. And it only applies to crops where the entire crop is harvested at once. Certain types of trees, I believe fig trees. Maybe someone has figs and you can tell me if this is correct or not. Right? That they differ on the same tree, right?
Every time you
So then the mitzvah peah doesn't apply there and it can't apply there. In other words, if I have a let's say an olive grove, olives I imagine are harvested all at once. Right? So when the time comes from the olive harvest, and it's probably not only me, it's probably everybody in this area that's harvesting olives, so then the poor people know, you come to the edge of it. Figs, if you harvest a little here and a little there, there's never a point where you could say leave the edge of it for them, so this mitzvah doesn't apply to those trees. Yes? Ah, very good. Right. That's not considered ochel. Very good. Right? If you grow things for animal foods, that's also considered something that you don't have to leave for the poor people. If it's the type of crop that can't be eaten by people. In other words, I might be growing barley to feed to animals, but people can eat it also. So then I have to. But if it's something that's only eaten by animals and not by people, then you do not. Right? Okay. Here, let's skip a little bit to the next page. The first Mishnah on the next page says, what's a field? What do you mean, what's a field? Well, let's say I have three fields. Okay, and I decide, okay, I have three fields that cover X number of acres. I'm going to leave, I have three fields, one over there, one over there, one over there. I'm going to leave all my peah in one field. It'll be the right amount. It'll be at least 1/60th of my total crop. Not allowed. Each field, you have to leave the edge of that field. But what's a field? Meaning, what if I have, so for example, the elu mafsikin lepeah, hanacha. Let's say I have a field where there's a natural ravine that goes through the field. Well, then that's considered two fields. Even though, in my mind, it's one field. I planted the whole thing, but you can't harvest it all together. You can't move your when you plow it, there's two separate, then it's two separate fields. Hashlulit is a irrigation channel. Derech hayachid, derech harabim, shvila. You have paths, you know, for the workers even, to go through the field. You have a certain certain part that's not, that you don't plant on. So that divides it into two separate fields, and you have to leave each one, and as you can't leave all the peah on one side, you have to leave a smaller amount on one side and a smaller amount on the other side, etc. Also, if you plant two different types of crops, you have one field. You decide that, you know, half of it you're going to plant wheat, and the other half you're going to plant barley. So first of all, if you do that, there's another masachet that we're not going to have a chance to learn called kilay. Right? You can't plant them together, you have to plant them separately, and with even a certain amount of distance between them. But then, that's considered two different fields. Last year, you planted wheat in the whole thing. So you left only that corner. But this year, you planted half wheat and half barley, so you have to leave some of the wheat and some of the barley. Two different things. And then it goes through, if you have different types of wheat, and maybe you planted they're both wheat, and then the law of Kilayim doesn't apply. You could even have them growing together, but you may be harvesting them at different times. Because maybe one type ripens earlier, and one. So then that makes it two different fields. What we're seeing here is something that's very common in halacha, not only to this area of halacha, this is really true in all areas of halacha. And it's something that sometimes people have a hard time with, because on the one hand, we, you know, for example, when it comes to laws of Shabbat, I've had many conversations with people over the years who said things along the lines of, okay, I get it. I get the idea that the Torah wants us to have a day of rest. I get that. But you're telling me that if you know, I left the light on in my refrigerator, I can't turn on, what does that got to do with anything? Or you tell me I can't get in my car and drive to shul, instead I have to walk for an hour and a half, you know, that's not very restful. In other words, we take laws where we understand, or perhaps we think we understand, the concept behind them, but then we have to translate them not into just a concept, but into an actual law. And the law, and law by definition, has details, and has, and sometimes has loopholes, and sometimes has situations where the spirit of the law doesn't always match up with the letter of the law, and that's always a struggle what to do in those types of cases. But the bottom line is, if it's a law, if it's not just an abstract moral principle, then it has to have real definitions. And you have to go and ask the rabbi, do I have to leave peah? Do I have to leave it once, or am I obligated to leave it in two separate places, etc. Let's take a look just at a few more of these things, and then we'll try to wrap it up and also talk about your question and about what we do with this nowadays. So just to show you quickly definitions of those other things, and the third one here, which is Perek Dalid Mishnah Yud, Ezehu Leket, Hanosher B'Shat HaKtzira. Leket is when if it falls off at the time that you are harvesting, but there are definitions to what it means. So for example, Hayakotzer, the guy was harvesting the wheat. Katsar milo yado, okay, he filled up his arm with the wheat and he's harvesting it. Talash milo kumtso, or it could also be that he isn't harvesting it with a sickle, but perhaps he's it's a different type of crop that he's just uprooting by hand. And then he kahu kots, and while he's working, he got stabbed by a thorn or something, and he said, "Ow!" and dropped everything, right? It's an example of something we talked about earlier. Haresha balabai. He doesn't have to leave his leket. That's not called leket. Leket is you're harvesting and, you know, one or two pieces fall down. You drop the whole thing, now you forgot it. And that, it fell off in the normal course of harvesting, right? But something went wrong. You bumped into a thorn or something, the knife slipped, something happened, you had an accident of some sort, and the whole bundle fell down, that doesn't count. That you're allowed to pick up. That's outside the framework of leket. So that's an example of the type of things we're talking about. And it even talks about which side of the knife it falls on. If it falls outward, that's not called leket. If it falls inward, it is, etc. Also, the next Mishnah talks about shechecha, what's called forgetting. And you asked, you know, how long do you have to forget and how far you have to walk away? That there's a Mishnah that talks about that I didn't put on the page here. But here we talk about something else. You have a balabait and you have poalim. Right, a lot of times people would hire workers to help them harvest their field, day workers, right? So you have the owner of the land who may be working himself or might just be acting as the foreman, supervising his workers. So what if the worker forgot it, but the boss says, "Hey, hey, hey, you left one," or the other way around, or the boss says, "Guys, come on, let's move," and the worker says, "Wait, you forgot one." So it says here, "Ha'omesh shachachu apolim v'lo shachachu balabayit." Or shachichol balabai below shachu apolim. Neither one of those counts, and that's not called forgetting. And also, if the poor people, you know, if the poor people deliberately try to make you forget something, amdu ha'aniim b'panav o shechipuhu b'kash, they cover it up, they block it, you know, nothing here, or look over there, or something like that. You forgot it. That doesn't count either. All those cases harezo eno shechicha. Shechicha is only if, in the normal course of things, all the people involved in the harvest left this area, moved on, and left something behind, then they're not allowed to go back and take it. But if one person forgot and the other person pointed it out, or the poor people tried to make you forget or something like that, so then it doesn't. And also how much you forgot, if you leave behind Mishnah, the next one, Perek Vav, talks about if you leave behind a large quantity, that's not what we're talking about here, you leave a whole stack of bundles, even if you genuinely forgot them, but that's already outside the realm of what we're talking about here, and that doesn't count. You're allowed to go back for those things, etc. It discusses also in Perek Zion the exact definition of what are olalot, what grapes, etc. Yes?
I don't want to take time to think twice, but one thing is wondering, all of it is very beautiful, perfect, just wonderful, practical, but when we get to the part about which side of the sickle the wheat falls on, I would like to know, if you could tell me, historically, when such a thing was discussed,
What do you mean?
Is this,
in the time of the Mishnah, which is the... These Mishnayot were formulated in the first and second centuries of the Common Era.
I'd like to know that what was the start of the setting, more or less, was it this in the middle of... what were the rabbis thinking? What were people asking?
No, this is very practical. No, but this isn't helpful. This is very... Again, I think the reason you and I are struggling with this is that we're not farmers, and even if Bimikre, someone here is or was a farmer, we didn't probably work with these hands.
How could it possibly matter? Why would it become a question of which side of the sickle it falls on?
I imagine...
Unless a person is being picky.
I can't answer you completely, but I imagine that if you or I were farmers who worked with these tools, we might see this differently. Because we know, I'm not a farmer either. I live in Israel, and I even have, you know, Arab fields near my house, vineyards that I sometimes go and look at when I'm learning these Mishnayot, because it's fascinating to see. But I don't work in these things. But perhaps it does, you know. Listen, it's law. I have a daughter who's in law school also, right? And any lawyer is going to get involved in, you know, and picking you in details like this. And sometimes, you know, a good lawyer will find a loophole and, you know, get you off when you really get you out of something you really should have. And then we have a whole different conversation about, you know, the spirit of the law. No, it might also be, I don't work with these tools, but it could be that maybe it's very common for it to fall on the outside and then you go past. I don't know exactly, because I don't work with this either, but I imagine it's along those lines. Okay, just we have a few more minutes.
Sickle is used in one direction.
Right.
So, you know, the cutting should fall.
So I think the idea is that, right, I'm cutting this way, and something that slips out of my bundle is leket. But if it falls on the other side, perhaps that means that it wasn't part of the bundle that I was cutting. And then
that's not the question. I think the question is, it's not like, oh, how does the sickle work? And it's like, what's the big deal?
But again, I'm not. It could be that if you or I were farmers who worked this way, we might see that it is a big deal. For example, let's say I showed you that every time you do this, there's a certain number that fall out, and it might make a big difference in the percentages. For example, I'm professing ignorance here. I don't work with these type of tools, but it could be that when you know things, I know from other areas when you. But I wouldn't know how to use them anyway. No, I'm serious though. But there's a serious point here. When you talk to people that are professionals in certain fields, right? I've seen this in other areas where things that even in other areas, when I was a student in yeshiva and I learned Masechet Bava Kama, right? You know, court cases and things like that. A lot of things seemed to me very, very same kind of deep, picky details. When I got older and I started living in the real world and I had a house and a car and taxes and things like that, I remember various points. I can't think of an example right now, but going back and realizing the things that seemed so abstract or random in the Gemara like make a lot more sense, because when you live it, you know. So I don't know the answer to you, but it could be some of these things might be that way also. It's law. Okay. Okay. I want to focus for a minute on Perek Chet Mishnah Aleph. Me'ematai kol adam utarim beleket. The nimushot are the term used for the elderly people, right? The elderly poor people who come with their canes, right? What we say in modern Hebrew, the most miskin, right? These are the people, you know, you have an elderly, and unfortunately an elderly person who's in poverty and doesn't have, not like Nami even, who had a young daughter-in-law who could do it for someone who's living by themselves, you know, and they're the people, even... They're going to be even a disadvantage to the other poor people. All the other poor people run in and they're hobbling along with their cane trying to pick up whatever's left. When those people also leave the field, anything that's left afterwards, that means no more poor people are coming. You don't have to leave it there to rot. The balabayit, if he wants, can go back and take it. In other words, peah is not, there's no obligation to leave peah there after it's clear that the poor people no longer need it. Right? When all the poor people have come, including the elderly people hobbling along with their canes, and they've all come and gone through the field, and if there are still things left, then the owner of the field can come along and say, Rega, there's good stuff here that I can, if he wants to, he has the right to go back and take it. Contemporary poskim, who discussed this, and this was dealt with in the early 20th century by the Chazon Ish and by Rav Tikhachinsky and some of the other great rabbis that we hear in Eretz Yisrael, who in our generation, or maybe a generation or two ago, in our Kufa, let's say, in our time period, when we have Jewish farmers once again farming land, this law is even applying in Chutz La'aretz, but in Chutz La'aretz it's a little different because there most of the poor people are Goyim, and therefore there's certain leniencies, and it's only Midrabanan there. It's Midrabanan in Eretz Yisrael today also, but they came and they asked this question, are we supposed to be leaving Leket, Shikha, and Peah? And there were some who said you should. But the reality is that in today's economic reality, no poor person is going to go and do this. I mean, think about it. You have people today that are in serious poverty, but first of all, Baruch Hashem, in most cases, they're not at the situation that they need bread. Most cases. We have, you know, generally speaking... Exactly, exactly. That's the second. But in most cases today, in our reality, there are people that are in serious poverty. They're usually not starving. Their needs are... And food, specifically bread, is not the real economic necessities nowadays. Food is... And again, this is a product of the Industrial Revolution, right? You can buy a loaf of bread for 5.5 shekels. Okay, it's subsidized by the government. So you want to buy an unsubsidized bread, it costs you 12 shekels for a loaf of bread that a person could eat for a day on or something like that. Meanwhile, they don't have health care and they don't have clothing and they don't have a house to live in and they can't pay tuition for their children. Those are the real needs, number one. Number two, you're correct. And even if somebody is starving, what are they going to do with... Does anyone...
Can you sell it?
Can you sell it? Can you grind it into flour? Our reality... Once upon a time, you took those things home and everyone had a mortar and pestle. It's just the economic realities of today are such that nobody is going to go... No poor people are going to benefit. They wouldn't even know how to.
Yeah,
the peya. Do they even have the tools to harvest this stuff? Do they have the way to grind it into flour? It's just not done that way. The guy's coming through with his huge tractors. It's being taken on a truck to a factory where it's being ground into flour. And therefore, the Chazon Ish and others rule that you do... Not because these laws don't apply. In theory, they apply. In practice, from the very beginning, we're already at the point where the elderly people have come and gone and nobody's left to take this stuff. Because you know Meirosh. You know from the beginning that no poor person is going to... It's not worth his time to go through the field and pick up individual stalks of grain. He's going to spend an entire day and not have what he needs, which is the fact that they're turning off his electricity because he can't pay the electric bill. Right? And therefore, just one second. And therefore, what the Chazon Ish and others ruled is that... Given that reality, that we understand that the poor people are not actually going to come and take it, that therefore we are in the situation which this Mishnah describes at the end of the process is already the case at the beginning, and therefore in functional terms, you don't actually, there are those who do, at least symbolically, perhaps to keep the memory alive or whatever. That leaves us in a situation, and again, this is the mirror image of what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about a case where the law obligates us, even though the spirit of the law can't be fulfilled. Here we have a situation where the law actually doesn't obligate us, but the spirit of the law, it's not because, you know, it would be lovely if we lived in a world where there was no poverty, and for that reason it wasn't necessary. That's not the case. Unfortunately, there's definitely poverty. These laws aren't going to solve the problem of the poverty, and therefore, it's incumbent upon us to think, what can we do to fulfill the spirit of the law, even though the letter of the law, perhaps we have a way out of. And I'll just mention two things. There's an organization that maybe some of you are familiar with called Project Leket. The organization has some other name, but that's their project. It's actually Peah. They call it Leket. But actually what they do is Peah. And I've taken groups of students, and maybe some of you have participated.
Matan did it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing, because you have farmers who... and sometimes it's really... because the guy wants to give charity. Often it's that, you know, a farmer will come to the conclusion that a certain crop, it costs him money to harvest the crop, and a farmer makes all these calculations. He's got, like, a field of potatoes and what he's going to be able to get for this type of potato on the market right now, the amount he's going to have to pay to harvest it, it's not worth it for him. Sometimes farmers will decide to leave, and he didn't get the crop wasn't so good, whatever, they'll decide to leave it. This organization, you know, has contacts with the farmers. The farmer says, listen, I'm not going to pay to harvest this thing, but you want to bring people, bakasha. And they bring groups of volunteers, and they come with a truck. The organization, you know, pays for the truck, whatever. The volunteers do the work for free, and it's also very enjoyable, fun. It gives people a little contact with agriculture. And then they take this, and they donate it to poor people. That's a modern application. Is it halachic? It's an interesting question whether the farmer is actually fulfilling the mitzvah of peah or not. But there's no question that this is a modern application of certainly what the Torah intended us to do. And of course, the real issue is charity. Just to address your question, the last minute I have, the last Mishnayot discuss details of exactly how much money a person has before he's able, you know, if a person has a certain amount of money in his pocket, he's not allowed to take payah. A person has 200 zuz, he's not considered to be poor. On the other hand, what if he has debts, and what if he has the money, but he's trying to invest it so that he can get a job? The Mishnayot, and again, the details of these laws aren't relevant anymore. We use different monetary units, and our economic realities are different. Even if we could figure out, which we can actually, you know, the amount of copper or silver that was reflected there and the value of that, it's clear that the economic realities are different and that it has to be translated into different terms. But the principle is a very, very important one. And anyone running a stucco organization has to deal with this. I'm sure in all of your communities, this is a real issue today. People coming around asking for charity, and not necessarily the people that are most in need are the people who get it. The people who get it perhaps are the people that are most aggressive or most know how to put on the best story. And the people, I know in my community, the rabbis, I live in Gush Etzion, and there's a committee of all the yeshuvim, and if people come around asking for tzedakah, they're supposed to have a printed form with their picture on it to make sure that and then people that check it. You know, the concept that, on the one hand, we have to provide for the poor, on the other hand, we have to make sure that the money is going to people who really need it, and not people who are taking advantage of the system. So that's built into these laws also. And again, we have to translate it from the reality of the Mishnayot we're talking about into contemporary reality. And in these laws, again, there's the challenge that, first of all, for a few thousand years, these laws weren't actually observed. And even today, the laws can't be observed in the exact format that they were formulated. And yet there's a very clear mandate from the Torah here that has to be translated into our reality. So I think that's what we've seen today from a second Peah. Tomorrow, yeah.
Would you be so kind, with us for a few days, to give us some biographical information? That's what most people do.
About myself?
Of course.
Oh, okay. Certainly. I made Aliyah 16 years ago from Muncie, New York. Grew up in New Jersey, and then lived in Washington Heights in Manhattan, and then in Muncie. And from the day I made Aliyah until about 2 weeks ago, I was the director of a seminary here in Yerushalayim called MMY, that perhaps some of you have heard of. I'm one of the founders of the institution, and I...
It's across the street from us.
Ah, okay. I know you look a little familiar. No? No? No, no, no. Okay, I'm out of it. They asked me to talk about myself. I'm finished with the shiur. They asked me for... Anyway, I just left that post after 16 years, and I'm a little bit of a sabbatical now. I'm studying... I'm doing some work editing the Koren Steinsaltz Talmud translation that's being put out. I'm taking a course to become a licensed tour guide. I'm trying to do a little personal development before I move on to my next position, whatever that'll be. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.